So how the fuck do we go about our life remembering that we're really not this little I in the whole world and everything seems to be set up to believe that we're this little I?
That's a lot to
do. How do you break that tidal wave of I-ness?
You don't.
You see it or you don't.
You don't, yeah, you don't, you can't break it. It just does its thing.
I mean, if you want to break it, you just like, I don't know, it seems to me, watch a movie or something. You know, you like what I'm doing, I'm listening to science fiction. I've got an audio book. And so, you know, when I'm listening to that, the barking me is just kind of looking at this venture. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I think that I still recognize that I am the listener. But the force of my personality is less.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe that there's like, you can go sort of above consciousness? I don't know if it's above or below, but you, like there's two ways to get out of that overwhelming sense of self. One is, you know, you drink or you watch a movie and get distracted, and that's like you just kind of go unconscious. Another one is
sort of numb at this.
Yeah, another one is to fully, I guess, integrate with the consciousness that is always here, that is bigger than just the sort of self. And a lot of, like, addictions, I think, are based on get me the hell out of this overbearing sense of self. It's just too freaking painful. Let me out of here any way I can get, whether it's shopping, drinking, gambling, whatever.
Yay.
Just let me the fuck out of here.
So
but those usually turn and bite you. They don't, in the long haul, work very well.
And what about the intense consciousness of a person that's manic?
Great fun.
Yeah. But I don't,
don't
think I'd want to be there for too long. It makes me too anxious.
Exhausting. Kind of fun. Get things done.
Yeah, get things to take advantage of it when the mood strikes.
Oh, yeah.
You can't break it, you know, through willful endeavor, right? You can't outsmart it.
Willful endeavor just reinforces the...
What is willful endeavor?
I.
Besides endeavor that's willful.
Yeah. Right.
I thought you'd say that.
Yeah.
To be willful is to have a will.
Yes.
And to have a will is to have...
Well, it's conscious action, right?
Self-will.
Yeah. Right. Well, this moment, nothing is true at all about anything. But that's a curious kind of relationship to have with how fascinating one's conscious contact is. Conscious contact is incredible. I mean, how many machines have we been able to concoct which can as a simultaneity of data input and output and response mechanisms emulate what this does? I mean, there are fantastic machines, right, that can see differently than you do and hear differently than you do. You know, olfactory machines are a little more complicated because that sense is completely bizarre, you know. Taste and smell is like, yeah, good luck.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, vision we've been able to emulate with recording devices and playback devices. and hearing we've been able to emulate. And when it comes to recording devices, right, tape recorders predated cameras, or cameras predated tape recorders?
Well, I think the pinhole camera is before any of the
okay.
kind of audio recording.
Yeah. Right. We haven't made a lot of strides with respect to machines, devices that taste or smell.
No, that's they can't seem to.
It's so etheric, right?
Yeah. We can imitate flavors and smells.
Oh, absolutely.
Producing.
Yeah, yeah, producing, right.
Flavors and smells are
right.
kind of a mystery to me.
Yeah, and many machines have, you know, adroit tactile, right, capabilities. Mm. Yeah. But we can't reproduce taste or smell or nuanced tactile sensation at the theater, right? But sight and sound and vibration, right?
Yeah.
We can kind of mimic.
Smell.
And consciousness is way stranger than the weirdness of olfactory sensitivity. What's the animating principle that supports the fact of your present experience?
What the fuck is it?
And you can't even find meaningful evidence within the biological field to justify the animation.
Well, you can see all the parts, but like, what makes it go?
Yeah,
it's pretty right. obvious when the animation leaves and there's like a dead whatever.
Yeah, that's right. When the biologic animation
yeah.
Ceases, that's, you know.
Or if you find yourself,
then you start to smell.
Yeah, or if you find somebody else, even sleeping, like, it's pretty unmistakable. Yeah. You come up behind somebody in an office and they're asleep, even if they're well propped up.
Yeah.
I can see it like that.
I
know,
see.
It's really obvious. Even
wow.
if they're not, even if you can't see their face, you
so
can tell.
So I'm like this, look, with a computer screen in front of me, I think.
It's a dead giveaway. Yeah, it's the two-finger, it's the two-finger sleep prop, the three-finger sleep prop.
I'm thinking very hard.
there's just really an unmistakable essence to kind of somebody in a meditative state or a sleep state or a dead, quote, dead state, just not there, a dead body.
Right. And so you are, one is we are remarkably acquainted with the intimate nature of conscious experiencing, of conscious contact. And we don't pay all that much attention, but we typically pay attention to are the egoic exploitations of belief and presumption. Mm-hmm. So let's say we're, on a Sherlock Holmes mission to find the mastermind, you know, the criminal behind all this. And take him or her down, right? Now, you can see in all of the enterprises that speak to the human need for spiritual nourishment and anti-neurotic intervention, speak to what? They primarily speak to the myth of self, right? The bizarre mechanism of individuation and belief systems that make it appear as if I'm living a life, choosing a life, the victim of a life that I'm not very pleased with. And so I want to amp it up, change my possibilities, my choices, my behavioral possibilities and choices, what I attract to myself, right? So if I'm looking to optimize joy and minimize the fear and apprehension, insecurity. And all of that enterprise is focused on, right, the mirage of the extruded self, of the apparitional self. And maybe that's why those enterprises can be very entertaining and take up the rest of your life and the rest of your bank account with no problem, right? Yeah.
Shatters rather easily.
Yeah.
That shell.
That's right. And they may not turn out to be, you know, all that enduring or endearing when it comes to an interest that you may or may not have for ingress into sublimity. Yeah. So why does IMS function, or the Omega Institute function, or the Kripalu Center function, or the curious out-of-body, you know, place down in Virginia?
Monroe Institute,
thank you. And that's just a few that, you know, come off the tip of the tongue, all right? We're surrounded worldwide by 1,000 institutions dedicated to some kind of ascension. But most of them, of course, are functioning at the level of egoic enterprise, at the level of belief and imagination, cordial and not so cordial, depending on how inside you get, right? And they're all run by a fair share of gifted and charismatic egomaniacs from all walks of life that, you know, can build these kinds of institutions and find the talent, right, to speak, to do the scheduling and the food and the garbage and the recycling and the computers and the utilities and the catalog.
And the guns, if you will.
And in some institutions, the guns and the gold and the seeds. Yeah. So isn't it marvelous just how much thrilling karma gets whipped up, right, under the auspices or inspiration of responding to your question, which is how do I break, right? How do I break this or break through or find a truly satisfying or nourishing window into sublimity, and not just repeat, right? On a cathartic, demonstrative, banal, and superficial level. Yeah. Because all experiencing, and the Buddha was, you know, fairly down with this from the get-go, is unsatisfactory. And so you can see the paradox that's already quite present in all of the institutions that dedicate themselves to spiritual endeavor when, you know, the master from 2,500 years ago that some give attention to said, all experiencing is unsatisfactory. You'd think that would be enough for them to just shut Kripalu down. You know what I mean?
Well, but they're big on experiences.
Yeah, but why bother, you know, right? But why bother shut it down? Build 10 more, right? For fun, we can get kind of a humorous view of what it is that we're up against when it comes to as bold a question as, you know, can I break this, right? Can I pierce the veil of belief, of anecdotal hysteria, of psychological time? And you'd have to be crazy. Why would you be interested in that in the first place? You know what I mean? Like, who do you think you are to even be interested in it in the first place? Not that I'm asking that, but, you know, you could say that the...
Well, everybody else does, essentially.
That's what I'm getting at. That's kind of, yeah. I mean, everyone does, you know. when you take this stuff seriously enough to start being a little weird,
yeah,
and noticeably so, right? Then everyone is kind of like put off by you. You're bananas. Why would you even be interested in this bizarre heresy? You know, no one can understand it.
Most people you can't even describe it to.
No, there's no way to even bring it up as a topic of interest. You know, by rote, by reflex, people just, you know, dismiss it.
Yeah, before you even get anywhere.
Before you get anywhere, there's no traction.
I dismiss it. I can't describe it. I suck at even saying what this is about.
Well, okay. I mean, that's cool. That's you could say part of that is a, you know, a cultivated kind of skill, right? Like scotch is a right cultivated taste, right?
I like scotch.
Yeah. Yep. So we tend to occupy a relationship with our own firsthand experience, which is of the nature of a bardo. It's a realm. It's not real, but most people would insist that it indeed is real.
The realm?
Yeah, the realm of self.
But isn't that sort of the only thing that is real?
Yes, and absolutely not. You see what I mean? It kind of like, it's really up to you. I mean, there's no independently vetted truth. It's just how you respond to the mystery of you, the myth of you, the authenticity of you. It's how you respond to you. Who's here to tell you what this is? The Buddha did not do a very good job. I mean, you know, despite how many people practice whatever Buddhism may appear to be, it's not like there's, you know, it's not like take a vow and get enlightened, is it? It's just not. I mean, do the work, get enlightened? I don't think so. You know, do alternate nostril breathing in Vipassana for 3 months, for 1 year, for 3 years. Go see accomplished lamas. And get enlightened. I don't think so. So, I mean, it's curiously steep. But it's a myth that it's steep. Because your present liberation from dreaming is at hand. No need for a 3-year retreat to find that out. You could pretty much find that out and with a Hershey's kiss and a sip of tea. You know? That saved you 3 years in a cold place on a stone drinking yak milk. Wondering how the fuck you're gonna get off that mountain when the snow is 10 feet deep. Yeah, a cup of tea and a Hershey's kiss is more than sufficient to peer into, let's just call it, the observational geometry of the myth of consciousness. Yep. Now, most of these institutions don't emphasize you know, the reduction sauce. They don't emphasize that it's remarkably simple without having to be too heavy-handed or heavy-handed at all to peer into the nature of one's experience of one's experience, and see that it is profoundly arbitrary. That it's not nearly as real as we insist that it is, and that all of our discontent is intimately connected with how we perceive the myth of consciousness.
I mean, isn't that what they're trying to do, is go straight to step two, which is like, oh, do this and it'll leave your problems.
No, I don't think so, because, well, they may say they are, but, and it's not important to take pot shots at the institutions, even though, of course, it's always fun, but you see, they don't, very few of them can articulate the gnarly least common denominator of the challenge and the myth and the puzzle of consciousness itself. They can all agree to suffering sucks. And so what they pile on are apparently remedies to, right, address the firsthand experience that suffering sucks. So do yoga. Eat more greens. You know, drizzle saline through your nostrils.
Meditate.
Yeah. High colonics can come in handy from time to time. But you see all of these remedies, and there are many, and they are exquisite. And some of the remedies are very demanding, actually, right? I mean, like yogic jhanic practice in the Buddhist, you know, discipline it's very demanding. I mean, it's lengthy periods of remarkably subtle and sustained meditation on the breath, right, to the point of transcendent bliss. But even transcendent bliss, if you could get there through, right, the discipline of jhanic mindfulness, may or may not deliver you to enlightenment, to liberation, to the whatever it was that the Buddha got underneath the Bodhi tree after a long night. Too strange. And you can start listing and lining up all of the miraculous personalities and practices and superstitions over the last 50, 60, 100 years, and how many of them continue to go strong. You know, they kind of fade out after a while. And you don't see a lot of, you know, 20-year-olds getting all excited about Mirababa.
What happened to that?
Well, it's like anything, you know. I mean, Krishnamurti died in 1986, and, you know, he was the bomb. But I don't know how many 20-year-olds.
I don't know. They have a thriving website.
Go in search of Krishnamurti, you know, to figure out what he's putting down. I mean, it might even be hard to find an Eckhart Tolle meetup these days, let alone a Krishnamurti meetup. You won't. I mean, you could scour the country. I don't know if you'll find one Krishnamurti meetup unless you're in Ojai.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's probably given by some kind of predator. That's how this shit goes down. Yeah. You know, I mean, Ramakrishna was, you know, he was a connoisseur of, you know, paramahansic tradition, right? Vedantic tradition,
yeah.
Samadhi, you know, on a dime, Mr. Samadhi on a dime. But how many people in their 20s or 30s are sniffing around, you know, Ramakrishna's teachings? I mean, the autobiography of a yogi is celebrated its, what, 40th or more anniversary, but, like, it's a ho-hum. Even though many people can speak to it as being, you know, life-changing, right? It cracked them open to start them on their seeker journey, their seeker-fucker journey. Yeah. It's hard to know. It's kind of a fun, but it's hard to know, like, you know, high school kids, college kids, young people in their 30s, what's turning them on?
You know, you would think that there'd be some responsibility for parents to turn their kids on. Now,
yeah,
for whatever it was worth, I mean, Be Here Now, when that came out, had a big impact on me.
Okay.
And somehow I communicated that to both my kids, and my one son actually just bought it like a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
He found it for a dollar somewhere.
Well, that's, yeah. That's the only reason to read Ram Dass.
Well,
so if you could find it for a dollar.
But at the time, you know, since Ram Dass was like, at least he was thinking in a more far out way than I was at the time.
Yes, he was.
It was like, whoa.
Yeah. You
know? Now, reading them now, I've tried to read the book. I mean, I've...
No, it's banal. Yeah.
It's like...
No, at the time, Ram Dass and, you know, Trungpa and other creatures and, you know, celebrity gurus were, you know, they were kicking up some good dust.
And now Krishna Dass is, you know, out there doing stuff, and I listened to him a little bit, and it's like, whatever, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you're down with, you know, the chanting experience.
Not that there's anything wrong with it.
No, it's fantastic. Sway, baby.
What about that guy whose book I saw at your house near Nirsagadatta?
Nirsagadatta.
Yeah, Nirsagadatta Maharaj.
That guy was pretty amazing.
That guy was, without a doubt, pretty amazing.
pretty amazing stuff for someone who wasn't learned in any of that stuff. It sounded like he was quoting.
Yes.
He got learned fast.
He got learned fast.
That was like pretty old knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that book. Not me.
Hi. Yeah. So I don't know how many, you know, I don't know how well I Am That is selling today. It may be selling twice as much as it did 10 years ago or half as much. I don't really know. Uh-huh. Well, and all of these contributions to a body of, you know, inspiration, right, are... They're great. I mean, they're wonderful. They're seminal, right? They're just fantastic.
But I have the feeling that these things that struck me at different parts of my life, I just kind of feel like I'm through with that.
Mm.
You know? Do you know what?
It reminds me of, there's a saying in AA, like, anybody with a head full of AA and a, you know, body full of alcohol is not going to be a good mix. It's kind of like, once this is planted, like, that it's kind of bullshit and it's really not going to get you anywhere. You try to ride that bike again and it just doesn't feel the same as it used to. It's kind of like,
oh, what fun. Thank you. Yes.
That's exactly what it feels like.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So this ratchets in a way, you know, when you're 20 and you're reading Be Here Now and smoking a doobie. I mean, that's...
The round pages are really good when you're a stoned.
Oh, yeah.
Totally. I know. That's the bomb.
You know what I'm talking about?
No.
The middle of Be Here Now?
Oh, yeah.
All the drawings and the you know, writing on it. That's the real shit you got to look
at. Yeah, you would know if you read it.
This is an instant drug. How fun.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
So, you can see how the delight gleaned from cathartic discovery, a teacher, a book, a da-da-da-da-da, has in a sense kind of a declining, right, certain declining value. Yeah. It doesn't make it bad or wrong or a waste of time or anything. It just has a declining power. Yeah. Well, the next train stop. Well, there's a bunch of train stops. I mean, there's the somatic, right? The somatic train stop, right? The healing part, right? The movement aspects, the somatic psychotherapies, the body work, drumming, the shamanic realms, right? The drumming and the rattling and all that stuff. Sedona, Machu Picchu, you know, ayahuasca, blah, 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 blah.
All that stuff.
Yeah. And even that stuff has, thankfully, not regrettably, thankfully, diminishing power.
Byron Katie had diminishing power. I always got something, but it got subtler and subtler and subtler.
Yeah.
In the sort of launching into the moon, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, this is not your failure. This is organic, right? Because all of those endeavors, as much fun as they are, they just can't produce the same serotonin that you got the last time.
It's like an addiction. It's trailing off. You know, you talk to any addict that indulges, and ultimately they increase the amount of the substance or the activity or whatever it is.
Yes.
And ultimately it starts to take more than it gives, and it doesn't give what it used to.
Yes. Yeah, and that's organic. That's not your failure from trying to get as high today as you got yesterday from the same dose. Mm-hmm. You just can't. Yeah. Yeah. Well, then so all these stops along the right, this train ride. You know, relationships and vows and retreats and sensory deprivation practices, whatever. And you're delivered like through a time machine back here.
Always.
Yeah, right?
Always.
You're always delivered. Sometimes gracefully, sometimes after a lot of vomiting or near-death experiences or, you know, God knows what, right? If you make it, if you survive it, you're delivered, right?
It's like shit. It's
back here. Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. Right. So this default, I don't know if you could call it a position, but it's not quite a position. You could refer to it as a, you know, a plateau, but it's not a plateau. The default is your present experience, how you are experiencing your present experience.
And it would make sense if you just come to that. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it makes sense that if you can come to that,
yes,
that's all you need. You don't need all the rigmarole.
Right, but you can't impose that upon a 16-year-old.
You can't impose it upon most people of any age that they're doing something that's going to get them somewhere.
You can't even impose it on yourself.
Yep.
Right? Despite your deepest conviction. You can't impose it on yourself even.
Although it seems to me that what I found is that I don't feel the need to have to impose sort of the opposite on a forced approach towards anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you should really appreciate this, or you should really do this, or go out. So I don't feel that stress quite the same way.
Good.
And so I'm seeing that as a positive thing.
Okay. Okay. You know, your therapist might have a different reply, but as long as you're seeing it as positive, stop paying the therapist and call the shots yourself.
Well, I won't tell my therapist.
You really... Mm. Uh-huh.
I mean, it's about the only thing I can say. You know, because as far as, it's just like what we're saying, it's you know, it's like you wrap it up and you know, peak experience and it goes down. It might even take a while to get that. Another peak experience, but they're not getting higher in elevation or anything like that.
The transmission is responding to an invitation to simply be. I mean, even being is so silly because it looks like there's a thing. It feels there's no optimal, you know, because there's no agency. So the transmission is responding to the invitation to feel your present experience sans agency. Because without agency, the inspiration to break through, to pierce, penetrate, or see something different, just has no legs. Yeah. You first have to purchase a ticket to anthropomorphization to then turn on it with irritability.
Purchase the ticket to be
taken. That's right. Give the ticket back. Yeah, just sit on the platform without a ticket and watch the trains go by.
I've been pondering how easy that would be. It's really tempting. I can't say that I'm doing it, but it sounds like it would be a whole hell of a lot easier.
Well, it's doing you. It creeps up on you. The intelligence, which has this miraculous capacity to feel itself free from the seductive imposition of agency, is already at hand. So it's not like you're discovering a thing that you're not. You become disinterested in everything that you're not to see what you've always already been. And if that's got you, then Thich Nhat Hanh and all of his centers can just fold up tent. You know what I mean? I don't care anymore. Not that he's not lovely. If he's still alive. Is he still alive?
He must be. I think we would have heard.
Yeah, we haven't seen anything on Time magazine yet, you know, lamenting the passing of the great monk. No. You see, everything can fold up tent when you turn the corner on purchasing your experience and then doing something about it because it's so irritating. Yeah. And the cash register is closed. Still, we can go on retreats and yoga up and have a blast. I mean, you know, have a blast. Go to South America, North Costa Rica, leave today, and take ayahuasca. Cavort with time and with ancient holy places. Cavort with danger, panthers. Yeah, why not? What this already is more fulfillingness than we can actually handle. But it self-obscures, not you. it self-obscures.
Seems like its main gig. What's that about?
Can't say.
It's like a massive game of hide and seek.
Yeah. Remember or not remember, it's not like there's something to remember, but feel your experience, whether present or the entire history of it, as you're just being along for the ride, right? The curious recording of experience only can be accomplished through a narrow, very narrow aperture, because this is too, right, cacophonously strange in each moment to be recorded with any accuracy. So the myth of you occurring to you as memory and circumstances and events is really an arbitrary and involuntary compilation of absolute bullshit.
It's little tunnels to... You know, but, choices.
Yeah, but aren't we really, really proud of what we remember about ourselves? And we'll put up our fists in an instant if someone, you know, challenges my beliefs, my religion, my superstition, my memory, my sentimentality, all the things that I've done. But it's not that difficult to see that what you remember about yourself is involuntary and arbitrary, and wasn't chosen by you to be the memory to have about this moment. It wasn't. I mean, that's not that difficult to see. And so how is it that we come up with such grandiose confidence in an etheric persona that doesn't even belong to us, and we'll defend it? We'll bloody someone else's nose. We'll genocide. Right? To maintain our Aryan purity. We are horrific. We're bad. Absolutely horrific.
And the more you travel and the more you know cultures.
Yeah.
The more open you are to accept differences.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you have other patterns and other parameters to compare. You don't see only one sky, you see many skies.
That maybe is why some people enjoy traveling, because openness is nice. Openness is nourishing. Mm-hmm. So if there's a conundrum, it's not one that occurred in your past or that will intimidate you in your future. The conundrum is at hand. And that is not a frivolous revelation. Because if the conundrum is really at hand, the way that you respond to the brilliance and myth of your own consciousness is going to be affected by that insight. You'll be less likely to take up arms for a better future or to supplicate, you know, the Lord on high to relieve your suffering. Or to tithe more generously to Olstein's mission, you know? But this shit is a radical departure from what presents as conversational fortitude in the, right, generic culture.
It seems to me in the generic culture, 99% of what you run across is do something to get you somewhere in the future.
Yes, yes, yes. The whole culture is, the whole culture is under the ruse of time and agency.
Yeah, and it could be focus on the past. I mean, certainly.
Well, you heal the past, so you're better into the future, or you.
Well, that's actually a positive side of it.
I mean, do this
because
practice.
Sometimes it's lamenting the past, just simply lamenting the past, especially with older folks.
Hang on, 12-step circle is all about, you know, you got to heal yourself, fix yourself, change yourself, so that you can. You know,
well, that's because you.
Well, no matter where you look,
hang in those modalities, you know.
No matter where you look, you're going to find curious iterations of confusion. Because this is brilliant. This is a very, very formidable brilliance, a very creative brilliance.
There seems to be a lot of, like, desperate grasping at identity. Whether it's the I'm going to save a planet identity, or I'm going to heal myself identity, or I'm just going to sit in one and be a miserable person. It's like,
well, those are three of a million.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, look at how many moods you've been the enjoyer of. There's no way you could count them or, you know, boil them down to, you know, 8 Enneagrams. Right? They're way too strange.
Especially somebody around that'll boil them down for you.
Yeah. You know, and you pay good money to be diagnosed through astrology and Enneagram and human design system or what's that stuff when you resist?
Icarus.
Some kind of body work.
Yeah, that stuff.
Where they try to push your arm down.
Muscle testing.
Muscle testing. Kinesiology.
Yeah.
Yeah. So everyone wants to diagnose you. And once they've diagnosed you, you know they have a pantry full of remedies that they are going to sell you as an annuity. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you go to the physician's office, you get diagnosed, and then you leave with, you know, scripts. Remedial scripts.
You mean the pharmaceutical industry's,
yeah,
PR?
Pharmaceutical or vitamins or nutraceutical or, yeah, you know, powders and high THC content suppositories. It's a thrill.
You know where to score some of those. Let me know.
I do. I'm sitting on one right now. I wish. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
THC's posture is like, I just never touch his cheek. Sorry. That's really funny.
Keep trying there.
Yeah, don't quit now. So, part of the puzzle then is an organic discovery which you cannot cultivate, where you simply find yourself disinterested in experiencing. It doesn't mean you've taken a knife to your throat or, you know, a lethal dose of something. Mm-hmm. You're disinterested in the extroverted expression of all consciousness has to gift you with. And you're still here. But you're not suffering on account of time. And you're not trying to make this different or better. You're not imposing some curious and subtle idealized expectation on how you're supposed to feel yourself or what level of cathartic vision you insist on having so that you can compete with Arjuna's vision of Krishna on the battlefield while lopping off the heads of his enemies. You see? This isn't shy. Bless you. This isn't shy. It's not nearly as pernicious a hide and seek as it might appear to be. It's playful. And it's easy to be astounded by the pageantry of consciousness and take on the beliefs, superstitions, and presumptions that, you know, this is your playpen. And so one wants to go out, right? Go on a big journey and discover as much as can be discovered. In all ways, right? Sensually and in all ways. But relatively few humans actually take it on, you know, venture out beyond the comfort of a certain style or rhythm of living, right? We nest. We just have a tendency to nest. So even if we leave the state and drive many miles away from, you know, the village we grew up in, what do? I mean, we get a job and find people to hang with and live as sumptuously as we can.
And then proceed to complain about the unbelievable predictability of it all.
And complaining is part of the thrill of it all. Right. That there's complaining and disappointment is, you know, part of how great this is. So you could say it. It's a curious kind of geometry, life geometry, to deal with the appetite for experience and the tickle, if it comes, for sublimity. I mean, how many humans, you know, live in a certain kind of inarticulate desperation? That, you know, use television and whatever else they use to get some kind of vicarious enjoyment from the drama fields that are depicted in the media. Because their own inner experience is spare or bare. And drugs and crime and, you know, dramas and violence and risk-taking, right? All kinds of interesting behaviors occur.
I'm trying to understand that in terms of beliefs. Would it be that when you've gelled into a position that when you see other things shown on TV or talk with friends or whatever it is, that the entertainment value of comparing that with what you truly believe to be true,
yeah,
is distracting enough that, hey, it's something to do, you know, and it might be enjoyable or might not be, but at least it's something to do. You don't have to sort of be desperately in free fall, you know?
Some people do happy hour every day.
Yeah.
That's the rhythm of the life.
Many people do. It's the household I grew up in.
Yeah.
Cocktail hour was a big-ass deal. Finally. It's 5 o'clock. Remember, Scotch old fashions. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's the rhythm of the day.
For many people.
Yeah. I mean, hang on to the thin veneer of sobriety, get through the work day,
yeah.
You know, try not to gulp at lunch, but once the office bell rings, I can get to one of several happy hour haunts where I chill with my brothers and sisters, and we drink till whenever, hopefully make it home safely, you know, not get the DUI, and do it again.
Just love with desperation.
It seems so organic. It's almost like this is the way it is. You know, this is like a rule or something.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not like some spiritual thing. It's this, like, you know,
yeah.
if you've inculcated these opinions in these realms and all this stuff, then you're always at bay, you know, with whatever else comes down the pipe.
One drifts through numerous concurrent and shifting bardos of identity and identity crises for the long haul. You're starting with, let's call it conception.
Till you get tired of that.
Yeah, it could happen.
Is it getting tired of it, or is it just something sweeps it away and it's like you're just no longer interested?
You start to see the pattern of it.
I think most people.
Here it is again. Oh, wait a minute. Wasn't I interested like this before?
You can't really say, you know, because you can reflect on your life or your observation of other people's lives, which is always more fun, of course, and try and say, oh, that's what's happening. But it's not really possible to say what's happening. As sincere as the anthropologists, sociologists, and psychologists are in, you know, charting insights into human nature, maybe not just from a research point of view, but with the motive of alleviating suffering. How far have they gotten?
Whack-a-mole.
It is whack-a-mole.
Papa John place it comes up.
Yeah. You know, we think because we have a very enviable body of encyclopedic, call it, you know, knowledge or reporting on the curious nature of consciousness itself, that some of these books must actually be true. But none of them are. Not a one is true. But as a body of metaphor, you could get a PhD. By studying what's not true with such a degree of concentration that someone will give you a piled high and deep right, degree. And then you can become expert in the field of what's not true.
I give it a little bit of time and it'll just be old story. Nobody wants old books, you know. Whereas there's a handful of classics, the rest of them are just in the garbage pile.
Yeah.
Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Give me the latest and greatest. And then that's pretty soon the old and old.
Yeah, so it can be thrilling or depressing to review how much everything is not true and arbitrary and contrived and fits within a very, very narrow bandwidth of so-called human experience and fills the libraries. And yet the libraries have not resulted in happiness. The Buddhism has not resulted in happiness. Faith in Christ has, maybe with the, you know, a handful of people like Joel Osteen and others, not resulted in meaningful happiness. The church doesn't behave in a happy way. I don't see the church being a conduit or institution that's loaded with spiritually ascended happiness.
I don't know what church you're talking about.
Yeah.
Pick a church, any church.
A lot of people, you know, that come to certain kinds of spirituality have a very common lament, which is there's no one to talk to in my neighborhood. There's no one for 100 miles that I could have a conversation with that really gets to the core of my existential crisis.
Huh. Well, the internet has helped. Mm-hmm. People get more specialized in who they connect with.
Definitely.
For particular things.
Oh, yeah.
You can find the neurosis du jour and groups to support you in it.
Mm-hmm.
For just about anything, I would say.
Yep. And, you know, we have no idea, living within the cultural rhythms of where we live, how it's going in Namibia or any place. How are the Europeans doing? How are the Grecians doing? You know, and the Southern Italians and the Finns. How's it going? How's it going, you guys?
They're probably just living like we are for the most part. We get big headlines.
Well, sure.
Most people just live in many respects.
Yeah, in many respects, yeah, you could say that humans live as humans live. And despite the profundity of communication that we have, I don't have this conversation with anyone, you know, outside of a small circle of friends, like Phil Oakes sang about. You know, I don't have any interface with black culture. I don't know who to talk to. You know, to ask reverends or, you know, peers of mine in black culture, hey, how's it going? You guys rocking or does it suck? Or, you know, you reading Nirsagadatta? You're reading Martin Luther King?
You just need that non-dual end to that.
Start watching the Nightly Show. It's right after the Daily Show. It's one of John, what's his name? I forget. The guy who's, he was one of the correspondents that spawned from the Daily Show. I mean, Jon Stewart just cracks them out. He's just a master at getting people started in their own program. So now there's the Nightly Show.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good. Blackout. That's right. I forget his name.
It's pretty funny, even in. I mean, I know there's enclaves in the Black community, but even in 12-step programs, it's pretty much white bread, pretty much.
Around here
it is.
That's right.
I know in certain areas it's not the case, but there's not a lot of intermingling that goes on, and that's a pretty.
Yeah.
It's a pretty open fellowship. You know, nobody's
going to
give anybody
money. I've been to a fuckload of, you know, non-dually oriented meetings and teachers and things like that. And I can count on one hand how many Black people I met in those circles.
Yeah.
Well, searching for enlightenment is the privilege of people who are worried about food and rent and other things, probably.
Maybe, yes. There's something to be said about that.
You can afford to have enrichment, at least until fairly recently.
But still, you know, when you look at very primitive Asian and Indian culture, you have a strong sense, right, of, if not seeking for enlightenment, at least cultivating the path of, you know, kindness, right, through yoga or Buddhist endeavor, in cultures where there is a great poverty, right? Yeah. It's interesting to get a hit on just how arbitrary and, in a sense, narrowly beamed your experience of your experience is within the cultural circles that you hang out in, right? When there's a whole world out there and we do the same thing every day. We don't take a lot of risks to explore new experiences or new people or new ways of being.
I was just reflecting on that yesterday. It's like I feel like I have maybe half a dozen different areas of interest that I, and interest is, I'm using that term loosely.
Yeah, and that doesn't include the bathroom.
Yeah. Well, that's one of them. No. Yeah. You know, but I just, you know, switch into these modes, you know, thinking about work, thinking about this, whatever book I'm reading or whatever, you know. I mean, it's just like a few things, you know, and then it's sort of all over again. It's a cyclic nature,
to,
you know, depends on the time of day and what I'm doing at the time. And
right.
If I'm trying to go to sleep or whatever, and it's like boom, 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 boom. And, you know, a little bit of something else comes in. Even watching the news, it could be anything on the news. It's still that paradigm of, you know, me watching, getting information in about the world.
Right.
Supposedly.
You know? Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And the information you're getting is, you know, filtered by the 1%, right? The 1/10 of the 1% that only wants you to see what they want you to see.
Yeah.
Anything else, you know, doesn't even get fed in. And then we construct, you know, the frame of a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not much time spent.
Mm-hmm.
You just free form whatever. And I have to say, that's one reason why I've talked a lot about it before, the commutes. Are sort of an open spot. That's an area where,
mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of times I am listening to something or whatever, but a lot of times I don't, and it's just sort of a free form part.
Yep.
Even that has its own realm.
Yes.
Or, you know.
Right. If we become realm dependent, which is samsara, then it's easy to see why there's complaint and disappointment, malnourishment. right? Because we're realm dependent. What's happening is either makes us happy or not happy. And as long as we're dependent on the realm and dependent on the consciousness that imagines itself to be experiencing the realm, which is even more strangely intimate, then this dissatisfaction lingers like a smog. And that, I would suggest, speaks more intimately to the question of how do I find the wormhole into sublimity?
And the dissatisfaction seems to increase the more, if one were to quiz me on some subliminal level, like the query would be, do you want to be here, or do you want to accelerate towards the future?
But, really?
You know, a lot of times I'm going to say, "Get me the hell out of here! I really don't want to do what I'm doing." Well, I'm going to feel pretty dissatisfied.
Yes.
You know, and the more I'm like, "Well, I'm okay," you know, chill. It's okay. I'm just hanging. You know. The more or the lack of dissatisfaction, I'll put it that way.
Right.
Maybe even satisfaction comes in.
Well, even the curious measure of satisfaction is also tethers one to a realm.
Yeah. That's why I'm kind of like saying a lack of dissatisfaction. I can
right.
at least say that. I don't know anything about satisfaction. That's just, you know, settling on some words.
I can't get no.
Yeah. Girly action.
Yeah. This astounding presentation adopts agency so fast that it doesn't give you a chance to say, oops. You see? You become under the sway, the hypnotic sway of agency so fast that you're doomed and destined for dissatisfaction. Even in a playland as richly strange and dangerous as our life can be.
I keep thinking about, from any given location that I'm in, like frequently, there's 360 degrees of places to go.
Yeah.
And I use probably 5 degrees of that 360 degrees.
Five degrees of separation. Yeah, that's right. You're a 5-degreer. Yeah.
And like these little paths, and that's all I ever do.
I challenge you to find a 6-degreer. It's probably hard to come by.
Well, that you're saying exactly what I was just saying. To,
yeah.
You know, I got to feel like these little tunnels out to never land.
Well, put yourself in the position of the President of the United States. Yeah. And, you know, all the briefings that happen starting at, let's say, 5 a.m. for, you know, what's going down, Mr. President. And then, you know, all of the politics, right, and handshaking and weirdnesses of trying to get anything useful accomplished in a sea of contemptuous disagreement.
I heard his golf game is pretty good.
And even something that is dynamic, right, as the data field that the president copes with daily on how many different fronts, right? How many different briefings? And you could say decisions are being made, right? Militarily and constitutionally. And I mean, it boggles the mind, right? Even that is like, I don't know, 5.5 degrees. You know what I mean?
He's got his ruts too.
Yeah. I mean, even within something that says, you know, full of that kind of dynamic, real time, right, if globally evaluative information, it's like, all right, maybe 6 degrees. Yeah. Uh-huh. But, you know, many people in politics and law enforcement, right, in whatever fields they're in, stock markets, right, bond markets, they thrive on, right, a certain kind of thrill. And I don't know if it's, you know, I mean, some of them do make quite a lot of money, but I think it's the thrill. It's trying to get as many degrees of their 360 that they can possibly fit into a day or a life. And when you're in the midst of very high stakes games that have, you know, reverberations, influential reverberations throughout the culture, you feel more alive. And if you're not plugged in that way, then maybe you put on a squirrel suit and jump off a cliff with a GoPro.
Or you become an artist.
Yeah.
As in the case of...
That's right.
George Bush.
You know, and if you're not an artist, at least you can follow them around.
Or you conquer the Everest.
You're right.
The pen of the attitude.
That's right.
Or you build homes for people. Jimmy Curtis.
So there's a very strange kind of plenum or membrane that you have to pass through, which is a withdrawal from the dynamic reverberation of human karma.
Or seemingly personal karma. It always feels personal.
Yeah. It's not necessarily a withdrawal from the senses themselves, you know, which is yogically encouraged in certain schools. That's a little silly. But there's the withdrawal from the seduction that this moment amounts to anything. You see? There's a withdrawal from the seduction that your past amounted to anything, that your present should be of a certain nature, or that your future should be fulfilled somehow according to your, right, dreams. There has to be a withdrawal from the seductive nature of past and present and future. Otherwise, you inhabit this astounding expressiveness as an agent, sandwiched, you know, on two slices of generously buttered thyme toast.
Well, you know, it's like you can't get by without you, you know. But the you doesn't have to be quite so heavy, you know. I mean, that's what it feels like to me, this heaviness. Of, I mean, you can imagine being in an intense psychological state of just despising oneself, you know.
That can suck.
And just wanting to get away, you know, suicidal, you know.
Sure.
But alternatively.
Alternatively.
I mean, you isn't going to go away. I have the feeling that it won't go away no matter what you do. But it doesn't have to be so heavy, you know.
That may be, you know, a satisfying destination for you and how you frame your experience. That may be good. That may be more than enough. You may be, you know, fall shy of that goal. Or you may be forced to go beyond that goal.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to put language onto what I kind of sense. You know, and that's, you know, in periods where I'm struggling, I'm very time-bound, and I want to be out of here, and I want to be doing anything but what I'm doing. I mean, this idea, this feeling of me is very heavy. And when I am able to just let it go, you know, and even doing some of the exact same things that I was doing in the other state, the me part of it is not very heavy. I'm just sort of floating along and doing what I have to do. I'm engaged in something.
It's lovely to occupy your life and not be belligerently badgered by the likes of you.
But it seems like it's the engagement, you know, that keeps one from being belligerently badgered, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's the engagement with life, or for whether it's a task, which I would say is less fun sometimes.
Well, again, it's
depending on the time.
You see, framing it in this way invariably makes it about yourself.
It feels that way so often.
Yeah. And you can only get so much mileage by making this about yourself or qualifying your experience as being likable, less likable, most likable, not likable at all. Well, you see, it's not...
That's only to me, you know.
That's right. Once you place yourself on the yardstick and start contrasting ways that you enjoy or don't enjoy your experience, you're engulfed once again, right, in agency.
Well, just to come up with that language?
Yeah, just to have that as
a model,
as a model of measurement, Yeah, right.
You know, I always had a little bit of difficulty with the Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi. With, you know,
a little bit of difficulty saying a lot.
A little bit of difficulty with, you know, I am, you know, think on the I am, you know, be the I am, or however it's expressed.
Uh-huh. Similar.
You know, it seems to call, it's almost like pushing you, you know, you feel sort of bullied into self-obsessive thought about self.
Well, but you are already self-obsessive.
Yeah, so why, how dare they push me even further?
Well, there, yes, I certainly appreciate the reply. But being already self-obsessed and self-obsessed with a fantasy is what proverbially gets us into trouble. Yeah. So their hope, who can speak for them, their hope is that, listen, we're already obsessed, self-obsessed. It's not possible to be anything but. You're the only one here. Who are you going to obsess over? You have no choice. So the hope then is to work creatively, constructively, playfully, with the observation that tag you're it, in the hopes to alleviate, right, suffering, not to impose upon you more pressure. I mean, Ramana Maharshi called it self-inquiry, right? Who am I? Right? A guy like Peter Brown, a more contemporary ventriloquist, likes to say, the who am I thing can get a little troublesome, like you point out.
Yeah.
So to soften the blow, it's, what is this? Right? Just a little more generic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, what is this? Not who am I? Right?
It's another form of koan, it seems to me.
Absolutely. Well, that's all you've got. I mean, this is presenting. What else you got? It's pure koan all the way down. It doesn't resolve. It doesn't land. It doesn't become the truth.
I mean, it seems to me that the acceptance of non-resolution is just the beauty of where it's at.
I would bet a whole bunch of very gifted and accomplished non-dualists would agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah. Yes. A playful, call it relationship, with irresolvability could, let's say, relax a fervent interest in enlightenment being an accoutrement.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Because irresolvability is so observable, playful, very instructive, poignant and profound beyond measure. And so shifting gears from imposing resolvability, predictability, and security to become lucidly relaxed with the revelation of irresolvability could turn out to be useful somehow. And that does suggest a withdrawal from the mean, right? From the cultural mean, the cultural superstition, the cultural agreements that insist on resolvability. Yeah. You're backed off a little bit from the hysteria that most humans suffer from. And thankfully, that disinterest could turn out to be a little like compassion, but not because there's anyone to fix, just because waking up has a more playful geometry about it. This is, you know, our clumsy attempt, right, at hanging out without putting so much human pressure on it.
As opposed to the hour of power.
The hour of power. That's right.
The hour of power.
You know, all the talking heads on TV appeal to our voyeuristic existential panic. And it is fun, for me anyway, to cultivate a different way of hanging out without brandishing so much, you know, human. This is a, you could say, a contemporary conversation of an ancient aboriginal practice of dreaming. That's where everybody went after dinner, right? To the lodge.
Oh.
To hear the elders or whoever, you know, was scheduled that day to tell some stories. So
you didn't sit around and do this?
That's right. Oh, really?
Whole different world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like that, you know. This is a lodge. This is a kiva. Cup of tea is, you know, the ayahuasca offering. The candle is the fire. And we come after, you know, a day's work and hopefully a little dinner. And go to the lodge, tell a few stories, participate in a, you know, in a curiously dignifying and transhuman kind of togetherness. And that's that. Why this otherwise beautiful way of being together has become so corrupted by mousy little motherfuckers trying to get enlightened. You know what I mean? It's like the whole enlightenment gig fractures the beauty of being together. It fractures it. All of these fuckers, these enlightened fuckers and their grandiose experiences, it's ruined everything. Because then everyone starts scuttling about trying to get enlightened. You're like, no, dude, it's not necessary. Besides, it's weird and not accomplishable. Yeah. It's much easier if you just chill the fuck out, come to the lodge, create a lodge in your neighborhood, right? Come to the lodge, tell a few stories, and just kick the fuck back. Stop being so goddamn human. Get a break from the news. Get a break from the culture. Get a break from all the criticism. Get a break from all the fear and loathing. Get a break from all of this artificially propped up horseshit that keeps you stupid and small and malnourished and in search of enlightenment. That's not helping you. Still, the yoga studios are overflowing. Yeah. Right, Kripal is not about to go out of business on account of, you know, the silly things that I say.
Maybe sell peace on earth like this.
Yeah, why not? World peace. And it doesn't mean to, you know, denigrate the marvelous nature of a journey into sublimity. It's just, at least in my experience, which is amounts to nothing, it's a dignifying way to make that discovery. It's a dignifying way to go through consciously, you know, the transmutative chutes and ladders of going through the wormhole of sublimity. It's the lodge approach. going to see enlightened celebrities on some retreat schedule? God. Fuck. It doesn't fly. It's nice. I mean, you know, if there's no one for 100 miles, you know, if you can go see an enlightened celebrity on some retreat schedule, okay, you know, do it. Leave today.
Sometimes, I haven't been in this group in a while, it's nice when these gaps of silence occur and we're just sitting, like, because that doesn't happen in a lot of groups I'm in. You know, I've gone to a lot of things and it's like, chatter, 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 there's no breathing, you know. As soon as that being is just nice, just with people. Being with people is nice.
Yeah, it is, it's great.
Yeah, just playing. Being with people without the pressure of having to
be goal oriented.
Yeah, in conversation or that. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Well, the basis that we come together is kind of,
yeah.
It's really not coming together as who are you, what's your latest, and myself, myself, myself. You just, like, at least have some vague inkling that that's not the cat's meow. It sort of leaves a little more space if the group is coming together on a different kind of basis. The, oh, look at me, and oh, listen to me, just doesn't really, it's not what we come here to do. And I think that's the succulence of the silence that we can find, because we leave a little more space for what this is. The invitation is, what is this?
That's the feeling in the lodge. You know, everyone comes out and settles down and hears a story and smokes a little tobacco and everyone chills the fuck out and gets a good night's sleep.
Yeah.